Welcome back to the Illumini podcast. This is Steve Kotfuss. It's been a while, a few months, and it's time to catch up. This episode that we'll follow here is the third we're publishing, and it's the third that follows a line of thought around an organization, Friends of Gong Road, that I've been involved with for, I think, 6 years now. And I've been involved as a photographer, a videographer, a storyteller. And this podcast is an attempt to expand on the storytelling of a remarkable organization that's making a real difference, specifically in Nairobi, Kenya, in the slums of Nairobi. This episode features Sally Kenny, who is a Friends of Gong Road sponsor. She's a volunteer and also a board member. She's a professor at Tulane University in New Orleans, where she's executive director at the Newcomb College Institute. Sally and I sat down back in November 2017, so it's been a few months, where we talked before the organization's annual gathering. And we were able to catch up to talk about her last visit, where she took a team of her students to conduct some research. And I think I find the interview really interesting, and especially some of the research that, the findings of the research that reveals some real impact and the source of the impact about volunteering and sponsorship and making a difference. And it was really great to visit again with Sally, who we met, and it was really great to sit across and talk with her about her recent efforts and travels and learnings. So, without further ado, I'd like to welcome you to listen in. It's about an hour long, so it's a little bit of a deep dive, but it's a long form story that we hope to tell and help people to really get some insight into this topic. So, thanks for listening, and as always, feedback is more than welcome. Thank you. Okay, so welcome. Today we're visiting with Sally Kenny, and Sally is executive director of the Newcomb College Institute and also a professor of political science at Tulane University in New Orleans. And what I'm really interested in, she's author of Gender and Justice, Why Women in the Judiciary Matter. And very specifically, we're going to talk a little bit about Sally is a board member on Friends of Gong Road, which is also affiliated with the founding of Gong Road Children's Association and its operation in Nairobi, Kenya. And we have a lot of backstory on that already, so we're not going to repeat ourselves here. But this is the third interview in a series about the organization and some of the very interesting new developments that have been happening with that organization. Sally and I personally met. We were just talking about this back in 2012 when we were both there visiting. And we were visiting the students that we sponsor. We had two. How about you, Sally?
I came in with one, and then the trip motivated me to choose another. And I think I have four now.
Oh, my God. You have four now. Okay. Well, you're an awesome sponsor. Well, and also a board member. So you've really immersed yourself in this. So this is the first time we've seen each other in 4 years, but I know that, you know, from not too far, too afar, I know that you've been really active with the organization, and it's been really exciting to see. You bring your talents to the organization. So you're here, we're recording this in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So you've been in town, you came in town from...
About 4 days,
okay. So you're on the board. Did you have a board meeting as a part of that and everything?
We did yesterday, yeah, and then the annual event today.
Yes, we're looking forward to going to that annual gathering tonight. So immediately following this recording, we'll be going to that event. So I'm wondering if you can maybe spend a few minutes and just talk about kind of what got you to where you are today with in terms of your interests, your professional background, kind of what are the kind of maybe walk us through a little of your history and how that's made that connection to talking about and being involved with Friends of Gong Road. And we can get into specifics of the travels of the what you're actually doing, but I'm really interested more in the background right now.
So there's really three strands that got woven together for this story. The first one is that I studied in England, and I studied comparative politics and African politics. And so I'd always regretted, you know, that when I, in graduate school, that I went exclusively into the subfield of public law, and I didn't pursue the interest in African politics further. It was something, you know, that I dabbled in as an undergraduate and found really interested in, and had a lot of South African friends and colleagues at Oxford during this sort of demise of apartheid. So when I met Paula again, and she told me she was working in Kenya, that really interested me, because that had been a lifelong dream of mine to travel to Africa, to be more involved in Africa. It was an interest that I'd never really pursued.
Can I ask you, what were you studying when you were in London then?
So my field in political science is public law. And so I studied employment discrimination, women in the law, sex discrimination issues, that sort of thing.
And then when did you meet Paula?
Well, Paula and her husband Kurt and I worked together in 1980 on a U.S. Senate campaign in Iowa for John Culver. And it seemed like, it's funny when we think about the crisis of our times, for those of us in 1980, it seemed equally like it was a turning point. The new right had started this new thing called direct mail. They targeted six of the most liberal Democrats in the U.S. Senate, and they were trying to make sure that the Equal Rights Amendment did not pass. And so it seemed like, you know, we were fighting to prevent the end of the world. And the only senator that won that year was Gary Hart, and Ronald Reagan was elected. So Kurt and Paula and I worked together night and day on this crazy Senate campaign. I went off to Oxford, Paula went off to Wharton Business School, and we never saw each other again. And Kurt tells a very funny story of about, we were at a Women on Corporate Boards meeting in 2009, and Kurt came up to say, "Hi, I'm Kurt Meyer." And he said, I had the blankest look on my face that he'd ever seen, and I had no memory. And then he went up to Paula and said, "Paula, I think that Sally Kinney over there." And Paula had a similar reaction, which was, "Who the hell is Sally Kinney? Leave me alone. I'm trying to speak at this event." And so, nevertheless, Kurt persisted. And finally, he said to me, "Kurt and Paula." And Kurt and Paula had actually shared a single fundraising position. And in 1980, that was a real turning point in the gender coding of campaign work, because finance was exclusively male. So Paula was this real trailblazer who was the finance director alongside Kurt for the Culver campaign. And so I really looked up to her and admired her as somebody who could, she had confidence with the senator. She was doing this job that women hadn't done before. I admired her relationship with Kurt, and we were just really great pals. So then after that hiatus, we renewed our friendship as if none of that time had passed.
Wow.
And it was really been, it's really been fun to reconnect. And then the third strand is a little bit less of a happy story, but it really, I think, is important to understand the depth of my commitment to the program, is that I grew up in Des Moines, Iowa, and my dad died in a car crash in 1972 when I was 13. and my my mom really kind of unraveled, and she was preyed upon by this con man who had read the obituary in the paper and misrepresented her, and he drove all three of us out of the household, me when I was 15. So I was independent from the time I was 15. I left home when I was 15. And I had this really wonderful experience of being taken in by this family that had small children that they wanted some help with and just some company, and being really assisted by other people who really had no blood or kinship relationship to me, but were just determined that they were my safety net and that they were going to make sure that I kept on the path. And so that's really been something that I feel was a real emotional connection for me with the kids, that I really wanted to pay that forward, that for smart kids who have potential, who through force of circumstance don't get a chance and could easily just sort of, you know, fall by the wayside with a very little bit of money and some attention, we could be their safety net.
Absolutely. So you met Paula at that point. So what year was that again?
1980.
80. And so at what point did you, Gong Road has been, what, last 10 years now.
Right.
So at what point did you intersect with that?
So in 2009, so when I re-met Paula and she said, oh, I'm doing this thing in Kenya, really, the thing about Paula is, you know, Paula's one, it's sort of like the geeky version of the cool kid. I mean, Paula's one of those people that all I needed to know was that she was involved with it, and I wanted to be involved with it too, you know, and that I knew that it was fantastic and important and going to be great. And so, you know, really almost instantaneously when she told me about it, I was like, okay, where do I sign up? And I signed up. And then when I went to Kenya, I was very similar to Paula in that my sort of professionalism went into gear, and I was thinking, how can we connect with this? How can we do this? How can I use the skills and knowledge that I have to help this organization succeed? And so we had some great conversations on that trip, and then I went back.
Was that 2012?
That was 2012.
Oh, that was your first time.
That was my first time.
Okay.
So I had sponsored one girl, and then I went back a second time, which was a group that we focused more on visiting women's NGOs. And then I've been back three times to camp.
Well, I remember on that first trip, we were coming back from Masamara, and we stopped in that camp.
Helen's Boma.
Yeah, that was...
We visited again. We visited that the year before last, and you wouldn't believe the transformation.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that woman is a dynamo. So she had this plot of land. They'd set up the Boma to help widows and girls who were about to be cut. Well, since then, and I think you'll remember it, even though it was admirable, it was also quite grim in terms of its accommodations. And she has built a school. She's put in a pump. She has a sewing enterprise where people sew and they make school uniforms and other things, like the backpack we bought.
Yep.
I don't know. I still have my backpack that says, don't sell girls for cows, give them an education instead.
Yeah, that was quite a tagline.
My husband's always asking how many cows, you know, for the PhD. But anyway, she also has a place now where visitors can stay and work. And so we took the students there and they helped with, you know, the school. And when we were there, we went into a room and six girls had just been brought there the night before by their teacher, and their teacher had gotten wind that over the coming school holiday, the girls were going to be cut and married off, and that was the end of their schooling. And so the teacher brought the six girls to Helen. They were locked in this room and guarded so that their families didn't come get them. And the girls sang for us, "You Are My Sunshine." Mm. And it was absolutely devastating. I mean, here were these girls who'd never been away from home before, and they would not be going home again.
Wow.
And it was a really powerful time for our students, too, and it really drove home the point about how much these girls and how much these students just want a chance to learn. It's a thing that we take for granted, but when you're denied it, it's everything.
Yeah, that is something. So you were there in 2012, and you were just there this last summer. So when were you there in between?
So I've been to camp three times the last three summers.
Okay.
So the first summer, I took a staff person for us to plan out. We were trying to figure out, you know, undergraduates don't have a lot of skills. They can't practice medicine or drill wells or do other development-enhancing things. And so for them to come and work for an NGO, it's really oftentimes a drain on the NGO, and I didn't want to be that for the organization. But we thought, well, undergraduate students have been to summer camp themselves. They've been camp counselors. They've been resident assistants in their dorm. They know, you know, they have things to contribute to camp. And so that would be a way that we could bring over Tulane students who were studying international development and wanted to contribute and maybe, you know, spend some time abroad actually doing the work and explore whether that was what they wanted to do with their lives.
So maybe just to give a little context to the listeners, so the camp we're referring to is an annual camp, and there's usually a series of two or three of these camps for different levels of kids, leadership camp and grammar camp, and so maybe we're jumping ahead a little bit, so we'll get to that, because I want to finish a little bit on your background, but this is really interesting. But that camp is a part of what Gong Road Children's Association performs or conducts each year, and that was led by Tom, who we've referred to in the past as well. I mean, the miracle worker there. But let's talk about the whole thing with your students, but I'm really, if we can back up just a little bit, students of yours or students in
your
program?
They're undergraduate students at Tulane University who are studying international development as a course, a concentration, or a major.
Okay.
And they take a course on women in development in Kenya, or it's been expanded now to women in development in Africa, and they develop a project in that class that they would do at camp, and then they petition to go and work at camp.
So is that a class that you're teaching?
No, it's the first year it was taught by a woman named Gwen Tompkins, who's a Newcomb graduate and who was the East Africa correspondent for NPR. And then we actually got a faculty member in international development who has a real interest in gender. And she teaches it now. Her name is Isabella Stefla, who's the one who did the research.
Okay. Yes, and we haven't talked about that research. Yes, so that's, we have something at the end of this discussion about some of that research I'm looking forward to talking about. So the class, as a part of the class, how many are in that class?
Maybe 30.
30, and so there's a number. So people petition to see. And what is the nature of the people who are petitioning? Are they all, is it gender specific? Are these just females or is it men?
Well, so far, so in part because the mission of the organization that I work for is to educate undergraduate women for leadership. So we don't have we would entertain taking men students who wanted to go, but our mission is to enhance the undergraduate women's experience. So, you know, that's not our primary focus is on women students.
Okay. And then those who, I'm just narrowing it a little bit. So those who would be petitioning, is that something where they go, oh, this looks like it could be really interesting to my future. Maybe some people are taking the class because they're pretty interested, but maybe not as committed, I would imagine. So you've got some who are actually petitioning. So what's that petitioning process like?
They fill out a form. I mean, I think about it, you know, it'd be the sort of thing that I would have really liked to do. I mean, when I was an undergraduate at the University of Iowa, I spent a summer at Oxford University doing through a program through the University of Northern Illinois. It was the first time I had ever been abroad. You know, it was a huge leap off the cliff for me. I mean, going to England. And, you know, the idea of going to Africa when I was 20 was beyond, way beyond my imagination. And so, you know, but the fact that I went on that summer program meant that I ultimately applied to Oxford University and went there and lived in England and studied British politics. It had a real transformative effect on me. So I feel like I really want our students to have those kind of broadening global experiences. And, you know, maybe the first time, I mean, if you think about our trip, you know, would you have just gone as a photographer on your own to Kenya? I mean, I, you know, the same with me. I'm interested in what women are doing in Kenya. Would I have just like said, okay, I'm going to go find out for myself? No, I needed Paula Meyer to lead me by the hand the first two times, right?
Yeah.
And now I feel quite differently about it. So
it is amazing how quickly things become familiar, isn't it?
Well, and also just, you know, I think that's true of any kind of traveling or experience. You know, then you realize it's almost like you have to articulate that you're intimidated, and then you can say, okay, this is how I'm going to manage that. But until you've even been able to articulate that, it's not even on your realm of possibility.
Yep.
So one of the things that happened the third year, the second time I went for camp, is that after we'd all booked our non-refundable fares, they changed the dates. The Kenyan government changed the dates of the school year. So all of our students were in school, but also the place where we hold camp is a school, so we couldn't go occupy it. So suddenly I had 9 days of programming that I had to do for the Tulane students. And I put together a really amazing set of things that we did, some of which, you know, we did, like visiting Helen's Boma, which was really amazing. But also, my research is on women judges, and so I knew some of the Kenyan women judges from the International Association of Women Judges. And we had been, I had given a talk at the Kenyan Supreme Court when we went as a group of women, and they invited me back to speak. So the students got to be in a room with the senior leadership of the Kenya judiciary talking about their frustrations and their strategy and how they were going to get more women to be on the Kenyan Constitutional Court. And we got to do a number of high-level things like that in those 9 days.
Wow, that's amazing.
It is really amazing.
Wow. So how does the book that you authored work into what we're talking about right now? Is it really an expression of that book, or is the book something separate?
It's mostly separate, although it's interesting. I recently wrote an article about looking at women judges in Egypt, Louisiana, and Kenya, but the book is comparative in the narrower sense of my research at the time, which was looking at the United Kingdom and the European Union. So my argument was that, and the book, I rewrote the entire book so that it's really accessible for a popular audience, and it's not meant to be just for political scientists. And my mom told me that is the case, and she gave me 5 stars on Goodreads.
Right. You know, the from your mom.
But anyway, so that just briefly, I argue that it's really important that women be equally represented in the judicial branch as a co-equal third branch of government that most people ignore, and that the arguments for why women need to be included are not that women are different from men and make different decisions. And we need to stop making difference arguments in order to advocate for women's full participation politically. So that's pretty much
the argument. Yeah, well, it's
argument.
Interesting. I realize one of my questions I kind of outlined was, I called it cultural insights, and where are there really differences you know, if you're looking, you know, if you're looking at the microcosm of the United States and or another set of nations, you know, do some of these things really apply universally, you know, across the globe? And, you know, are there more similarities than differences when you really look at the situation, you know, the challenge that you've been kind of working on?
Well, one of the things Paula and Tom wanted me to do the first year I came to camp is to do some teaching about gender with the students in leadership camp. And so it was really important to me that we use Kenyan examples. And there'd been this huge issue in Kenya of women being stripped, basically waiting to take these group taxis, matatus. And the official story was...
When you say stripped...
I mean surrounded by a group of men and having their clothing forcibly removed from them publicly.
Really?
Yeah. It's if you watch the videos of it on YouTube, it's like watching a beheading. It's okay. So profoundly disturbing. I've never watched a beheading, but I can tell you that the strippings are really disturbing. And, you know, the women are afraid they're going to be gang raped. They're humiliated. They're traumatized. It's a deeply, deeply horrific practice.
And the purpose of it is?
Well, it's interesting. So the official story was, these are women who are wearing Western dress that is not modest, okay? And they're being sanctioned by their community. Well, when we talk to women activists in Kenya who've been working on this issue, and they actually passed legislation on this issue, and there was a huge uprising. What they said is what happened is anybody who rides a matatu in Kenya will be familiar with this practice. The men who solicit riders are engaged in a lot of street harassment. So they're calling out, making comments about your appearance, your sexual desirability, your racial characteristics, all of those sorts of things as they pass you on the street. And occasionally women answer back something, I presume, on the lines of in your dreams or go to hell or something stronger. And that it was a response for basically backtalk to the matatu drivers. So we had a really interesting discussion among the students about, you know, what they think about Western and non-Western dress, what they think about women's safety, what they think about women's agency, what they think about violence in their communities, what it feels like to be a woman on public transportation in Kenya, you know. So there's things that are different, and there's things that are really similar.
Yeah, wow. I had no idea it would be that some of those differences would be as stark, even though you try to describe what it's like to be in the slums of Nairobi. And it is one of those things that's just hard to describe.
Right, but it's also, I remember in 1986 when I moved to Washington, D.C., you know, there was so much catcalling on the street. We went to look at an apartment, and we were getting so catcalled in the car that we thought we could never live in this address. Like, if we can't even drive down the street in a car, how are we going to walk down the street a day and night while people are yelling things at us? You know, so, you know, there's urban environments here, construction sites, other places where women sort of feel on edge that they have to walk this gauntlet of commentary that's mildly threatening, right? And that if they answer back, one of the reasons women oftentimes don't answer back and rebuff is because they think things can get violent really fast.
So let's bring this back to Friends of Gone Road and your recent visit. So this year, we've been kind of working towards kind of discussing what Gone Road does from kind of a thematic standpoint, and it's kind of called Ready, Willing, and Able, and the idea that the ready is really some of the academic basics. We didn't want to oversimplify it as being like a pyramid, but in some ways it is like that, where you have the kids are really accessing, because of the sponsors, and the support that they're getting. They're accessing quality education. They're getting good academic rigor. They're able to be in settings that are supportive of gaining access to education that they would not otherwise get. The willing part, ready, willing, and able, the willing part is about the kind of the supportive community. And you know, over the last 10 years, that willing part has been some of the things that have been brought by the organization, whether it's the Saturday program, whether it's being, you know, some of the food that they receive, whether it's some of the nutrition, some of the health care, very importantly, some of the support just from a caseworker standpoint to make sure that the kids are supported in their home environments so that they're ready, they're in that position to be able to go to school. And so some of this willing has been about really empowering the students and having the students feel like they want to be there. They want to be there because they know it can be, they can be there. But it's also their sense of being a willingness, like they have a belief that there's more than outside of their immediate neighborhood. And to pretty much most of the past, that's been done through the organization through some of these programs, and also the summer camp, which has been a huge part of it, and any student will always say that's the highlight of the year. But what's really interesting, it seems recently, and I don't know if I'm misspeaking, it seems like it's only been in the last 1, 2, or 3 years, is that some of the resources, time, and talents, and perspectives of the volunteers, such as yourself, have really stepped up in terms of bringing some of these other perspectives and resources to the program and really providing some of the emotional support. They're often being referred to as soft skills, but that seems to be, you know, but it's that sense of embodiment, the sense of purpose, the kids actually believing themselves. And I guess, so you brought in, because of your background and this whole perspective of human rights, I guess that seems to be the most general way I guess I would think about it, and knowing that kids do have rights and as they grow up, and especially women, girls, because their culture has not always explained that to them. So you're bringing this new, a relatively new perspective in to some of the students. So I'm wondering if you can talk about not only specifically what you're doing, but kind of how it's being received. And then in the end, maybe some of the things, everything's a learning process, right? So what are we learning from that process? Where you see this going?
So for the last 8 years at Tulane University, I have run a women's leadership program. And so I've been learning a lot about leadership. And I believe, under the model of transformative leadership, that emotional intelligence is the sine qua non of leadership. And also, really, of a certain kind of individual achievement as well. And my take on that is to really add the gender dimension of emotional intelligence and leadership, like the fear of sexual violence, right? But also, you know, my own personal experience in terms of thinking about my own emotional development and my own way of being in the world. In New Orleans, one of the many great things done by my colleagues at Tulane University is they're really trying to articulate what it is to create trauma-informed schools. Right?
Trauma-informed
schools. Okay. So, you know, when you see kids acting out in school, is it because you're a bad kid, or is it because you witnessed domestic violence the night before, or you have a parent who's in jail, or you saw a drive-by shooting, right? And or you're food insecure, or, you know, many... And the thing that's true about poverty is you're likely to have all of those things. So I happen to know from personal experience the single most, if you look at the ACEs test that measures trauma, the single biggest item is death of a parent. We have a number of children that have witnessed the death of both of their parents, many of their aunts and uncles. Many of the kids have never really had any men in their life, let alone men who work in the formal economy or who show them what it is to lead a good life. And they watch their mothers labor under these crushing burdens of subsistence, economic production, and multiple childbirths. And they are trying to figure out that story, where that story fits into their own determination to succeed. And I think there's a couple of things I think that we're really discovering is by we're trying to speak directly to that experience with the kids and to acknowledge those things and to try to give them some coping tools as well as just love and attention, is that that's something they have to work through.
So specifically, you're going to camp this last trip, and you brought a kind of a team of students and professor who's teaching this class, is that correct?
Yes.
So I wonder if you can talk about that, and maybe that'll help to kind of operationalize what you're talking about.
Right. Well, so one of the things that Professor Isabella Steffla did the year before last is she did this exercise that originated in South Africa called Tree of Life. And you draw this tree, and I've forgotten what all the elements are, but you know, the roots are the values you've inherited from your family. And it may be about your ethnic identity, your spiritual identity, some of your core values, whether you're a musical person, an artistic person, those kinds of things. And then it moves along and you think about what are your strengths, what are your hopes and dreams, what do you want to be someday? And then there's a compost pile, like really bad things that have happened in your life that you're ready to recycle and use to make good things in your life.
Wow.
And then those things that you're not ready to tackle right now. So one of those things, you know, might be being a survivor of sexual assault. Like, you don't really know where that fits in your story and you're not ready to talk about that. But losing a parent to AIDS, or might be something like you're ready to put in your compost bin. And so we had the kids do that exercise led by her. One of the things that I thought was particularly moving was not only the content of what they revealed, which usually started with, I come from a humble background. But then there was a row of boys in the front who shared this, you know, deep emotional content of how they were telling the story of their lives and what they'd watched their mothers go through. And then at the end of the sharing, this boy would say, and now my friend Francis is going to share.
Wow.
So they said, I'm sharing, and so will you, my friend who's sitting next to me. And it was really a great illustration of the magic of the cohort effect, right? That these are not, you know, they're not the only kid in the class that's lost a dad. They're not the only kid in the class that's from Daggeretti. You know, they're not the only kid that maybe didn't have breakfast that morning. And they're all doing this together. And I think that's a really critical part of the success of the program.
Wow. Wow. So they're going through this process of this revealing, and then what happens?
Well, then through the skill of the leader, I mean, Isabella is sort of showing them, I think one of them is like the leaves is things you do every day. And so she's actually connecting them that you can have values, but if you don't have discipline in everyday activities, like you can want to be a doctor, but you don't get there by just, you know, watching TV. That there are these practices and these disciplines that lead to the success of where you want to be in these steps. And I think that's one of the things that our kids really don't get. I mean, they don't really have a school counselor. They don't have the uncle who's the lawyer. They don't have the next door neighbor who's the judge. They don't have a cousin who already is in medical school. They don't have all those elements of social capital that I think many of us take for granted. That if we don't know somebody, we know somebody who knows somebody who's doing something that we want to know about and how to get there. A lot of our kids don't have that. And so that's one of the things I think that we can provide to them quite intentionally.
As sponsors.
Exactly.
So you said that when you were there, some research was conducted. Can you describe that?
So what we wanted to do is really try to disentangle of the many things we do, how do we disentangle the causal impact of the variables or the synergistic effects of the variables? So is all of our success due to the caseworker? Is all of our success due to the feeding program? Is our success due to camp? Is our success due to the cohort effect? Or are we kind of like Harvard University? We just pick the smartest kids and then claim credit for their success, okay? So is it that we're doing something, or is it, how does the magic work? Why are we outperforming the Kenya national average every year, even though our kids have more problems? They don't have medical care, they don't have parents, they don't have money, and the schools they go to are inferior, yet they're performing at a very high level. Why is that? So that was the objective of the research. And so really, she interviewed 40 of the students at Leadership Camp as kind of a pilot study to start to do that. And we found out all sorts of things we weren't looking for. And one of the things that we found out that we absolutely is the huge effect of the sponsors' letters, which was very sobering to me because I am not a dedicated correspondent.
Me either. Me either.
Right? Although, you know, both of us are unusual in that we've both been there and met our child. Okay? And also, I'll just be really honest. Despite everybody's best efforts, a lot of the correspondence is somewhat unsatisfying to me, mm-hmm. in that, just to speak really frankly, you know, so my children will say, I love you. They'll write a lot of religious writing. I'm not a person of faith, so that doesn't really connect with me. And they don't really necessarily, they're not revealing things about themselves. It's very superficial and chatty, right? I went to camp. I really liked seeing the elephant when we went on the trip. And so you sort of don't feel like you know this person's deepest fears, hopes, and dreams, and that they know yours.
Absolutely.
And we also feel very much, I feel, like one of the impasses in my own writing is I'm always struck by my own privilege, because the first thing I oftentimes want to report is, well, I'm off to Minnesota for a board meeting, getting on another plane, staying at another mm-hmm. hotel, right? I might as well be telling them I'm on the moon.
Right, right.
So what do I tell them about my life that can be meaningful?
It's so funny you say this, because I've struggled exactly with what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I tried a new tactic this time, which because I don't do very well at the writing. But what I noticed was my students' penmanship was beautiful. It was beautiful. And maybe that's the luxury of not having, you know, not having the laptop, right?
Right.
You know, and I love to have, I've always taken pride in my own penmanship and calligraphy and things like that. So I decided to deliberately write a letter on paper, and then I took pictures of it and said, I want to send this, because I said, I acknowledge the penmanship. I said, that's something that's kind of lost. I was trying to find some kind of a personal connection,
right,
beyond, like you're saying, we went to camp and saw an elephant, or saw the big five or seven. Or
right,
whatever.
And may God bless you for your work.
Yeah, and so it sometimes it's like I was trying to find a creative way to connect, like beyond that. But I do think it is a struggle, because it is, And with that frequency and sometimes the age, you know, it's what can you expect?
So one of the girls that I kind of adopted as my own, because she's sort of the best friend of one of the girls I sponsor, so I take them together for various things because it's fun. She says she's never, her sponsor is very generous to the program, but she's never heard from the sponsor. And so the kids ask you about him. So we as sponsors kind of have this feeling like, okay, we're supposed to do this. We don't feel we do it very well. We don't do it as often as we could. And we're suspicious that it's not very meaningful to the child. Okay? Yet, we find it's profound.
Wow.
And it's profound, we think, in because, you know, if I think back about, you know, my own experience of losing my dad and being really adrift and completely on my own, if I just kind of dropped out of society, I was really letting down the teacher debate coach who took me back and forth to where I lived every day, even though he didn't have to, and this family that took me in. Like, here were these people, it wasn't their job, they're not well-paid people, and they saw something in me and wanted to facilitate my success. And what it matters is that one thing that is somewhat troubling is that I believe many of them internalize the racial hierarchy that they have grown up in our world. And so the fact that a white person believes they're worthy of investment carries a lot of weight. They also see us as hugely successful. I don't always see myself as hugely successful. I see myself as doing some things well and other things not so well. They see us as, here's strangers who are so wildly successful at their professional endeavors that they can afford to pay for a stranger's education. To them, that's like the pinnacle of success. And they're the ones who are the beneficiaries of that. And so when you add that to their guardian, their caseworker, their cohort, it creates this mutual obligation, kind of a social contract, that propels them, I think, through really difficult times, independent of how competent and skillfully we are at being pen pals.
Interesting. Interesting. That's really...
And we did not expect to find that.
Very interesting. Wow. Well, I think that's the part about this organization and being a sponsor. When, you know, you describe the program to other people, that's really the one-on-one relationship is the most compelling part of the story to me. That's the part, like, it differentiates it from any. It's not money going into a pool and getting distributed and whatever. It's that connection. And I think that is a really interesting part. The model is very, very compelling. That's what maybe also, in a long run, is also one of the challenges to the organization, you know, as it grows, because it is growing and there's high demand. I interviewed the new program director, and she said there's a waiting list that's so long, and there's people crying in her office almost every day wanting their kids to be sponsored. So, you know, but you know, there's only a, you know, getting more sponsors is having. You could just do so much, right? And it doesn't become one-on-one if you take on 50 kids as a sponsor, right? You just lost the whole idea. So, and you're up to four, and that's, you're...
It's so funny, though, you know, because here's I'm an intellectual. I'm very cynical about so many things. But the intention to connect works despite all of our incompetencies. So I remember when I, like this time at camp, I was saying goodbye to the kids and it was so emotional, you know, because I'm really, really attached to these children. And I said, I have no children of my own. I have your faces on my refrigerator. And then I thought, how stupid was that? You know, they don't have refrigerators. Like they don't have the practice of the Christmas card or the children's photos on the refrigerator or the pride of place. You know, like I also believe that however ineptly I conveyed to them that they really matter in my life. And the fact that they know they matter in my life is a positive effect in their life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it doesn't require daily contact and it doesn't require a lot of money. And I think that's what's so satisfying to us as sponsors and continues to make us feel that it's so rewarding, even though I repeatedly, you know, I think you felt this way when you came back. I felt this way really strongly when I came back this time. We have so much money and the need is so great and what we do is so inadequate to the need that it's completely paralyzing. Yep. I was trying to explain this to a colleague who takes students to St. Martinique every year, and then they were struck by the hurricane and everything. And you know, and she was saying, well, how did it go with the Tulane students? And I just started to cry and I say, we're not doing enough. We are not doing enough.
Mm-hmm.
We're not doing enough, but what we do creates this magical impact that is very rewarding. And while we look for ways to change the world, political economy, and find a cure for HIV and all of these other things, these children are growing up.
Yep.
And we can change these lives before us.
Yep, just one by one. Exactly.
By a personal interaction and saying, I care enough about you to help you go to school because I know how much you want to learn and how committed you are to using that learning to better yourself and the people around you.
Yeah, that's really wonderfully thought. So I think we should close things down. We have an annual gathering to get to, but I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about where you think you might take this into the future? Is this something you kind of plan to do on a regular basis? Or, you know, is the research something, okay, we learned this, now maybe board member, how do we look at operationalizing this in other ways? Or even as your academic perspective, will you continue to be going to the camp and having that as a part of a class that students go to? That's a lot of answers to close things out, but...
Well, so one thing is that, so just from an academic point of view, the reason I left the Humphrey Institute and took over this job 8 years ago at the Newcomb College Institute is I really believe in this idea of a synergy between research, teaching, and service, that those things are not separate and that they're most effective when they're done together. And so I actually feel like what started off as a global service project through Professor Stefia's work, we made connected with the teaching, and now we're getting to the point with the research on what explains our success. But also we're launching in a few weeks a peer sex education program where our students will be the sex ed educators of each other, because we've had a number of pregnancies that have really derailed girls' chances at educational success. And so we want to do research to see if that's the model that is as effective as we hope it might be. And so I really feel like over time, we are slowly getting to the place where we're really seeing that synergy, that it's not just Tulane students going and doing service, but it's teaching and research all wrapped up in one, which is what I wanted to do at the Newcomb College Institute. The other thing I have to say is, I think it was before I went in the last summer, you know, my husband said, don't promise that you'll go again. So the first year at camp, we were going off for an outing. And I was rolling my suitcase. And Timothy McCallway is one of the really adorable students. He like stopped and looked stricken and he said, "Oh my God, Sally, are you leaving?" And I said, "No, I'm just going for the day. And you know, but I'm also gonna come back next summer." And he goes, "That's what people always say and they never do." And then so the next summer, you know, my husband said, "Don't promise you'll go the next year." And so I thought, I'm not gonna make that promise that I'll go every summer. And then right before I left, I met with Barbara and Michael Ochara, who are two post-secondary students who are really brilliant, brilliant students. They've lost both of their parents. They are really mature, wise students that I think really highly of. And I went to say goodbye to them, and they left. And then Barbara came back after they'd left and threw her arms around me again to say goodbye. And I said, "I'll come back next summer." So
best laid plans.
Yeah. I mean, really, this is the thing that we want our volunteers to be constants in these children's lives who don't have constants. And I know that feeling of not having constants. And so I can't promise that I will be the best correspondent I always want to be, that I'll be everything for them, but I will be something for them. And that I really get an enormous reward. I see it as it's a gift that's been given to me. It's not a sacrifice that I make. I feel like I'm really, really lucky that I have these children in my life.
You know, that's a wonderful way to complete this, and I totally relate to everything you're saying. And it's really been nice to talk to you. I feel like, boy, we're both kind of choked up here right now, I know. But it's really wonderful to kind of understand. Not only, you know, sometimes you kind of innocently step into something and you realize that, you know, you're in it deep and you realize that that's where you want to be. You know, it's wonderful. So that's the part that's, I think, is pretty miraculous about this program, and seeing the kids with their success and the way they respond, and you can see it in their eyes. I mean, for me as a photographer, you see the brightness, and you know, that's what draws me. I keep going back because it's like, oh my gosh, you know, these are lives, you know, and they're all sparkling, and they know that, you know, their sponsors and the organization it's been a lifeline. And they take full advantage of it.
They do.
Yeah. So thank you again so much.
Thank you.
And again, this will be another episode of our podcast series. And we'll be following up with some other volunteers who are doing some really important work. But thank you so much for your time. And it's really fun to see you again.
Thank you. Likewise.
Okay. Bye.